Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Filibusters have weaponized and abused. While the state legislative assault on voting rights is simple, all you need in your House and Senate is a pure majority. In the United States Senate, it takes a supermajority, 60 votes, even to get a vote, instead of 50 to protect the right to vote. State legislators can pass anti-voting laws with simple majorities. If they can do that, then the United States Senate should be able to protect voting rights by a simple majority. Today, I'm making it clear, to protect our democracy, I support changing the Senate rules, whichever way they need to be changed to prevent a minority of senators from blocking action on voting rights.
That's President Biden speaking in Georgia this week. The White House is quickly backtracking from what it sounded like he was saying in portions of that speech, that those who opposed his voting rights bills were essentially racist and undemocratic and against free and fair elections. Well, what did the president mean? And does election integrity actually matter to every American? Maybe for different reasons, but every American. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to be talking about election integrity with Molly Hemingway of Fox News. A little bit later, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. You can vote when we get to Soundbite of the Week by just giving us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE. Molly Hemingway is a regular guest, a Fox News contributor, senior editor of The Federalist, author of the book Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections, and a recent column for The Federalist titled GOP's Old Guard Out of Touch with Their Voters on Election Integrity. Molly, welcome back.
It's great to be here with you.
Very anxious to hear your reaction to President Biden's speech in Georgia this week.
Oh, I don't know if I have much of a reaction. It was interesting that he gave it. I think he's struggling in so many different areas in the country with the economy, with failure to pass some of his legislation, with foreign policy, the border. I think he was probably trying to, I actually don't know what he was thinking. He was trying to get a win, but he gave a speech that in a narrow Democrat echo chamber might have sounded really great and would have roused the base, but he called anyone who disagreed with him on federalizing elections a racist and aligned with the Confederacy. And it had the exact opposite effect of what you would think he wanted, which is it empowered even some Democrats to say that they wouldn't go along with his plan to change our election laws by taking them over at the national level.
He called the pre-pandemic voting procedures to which many states are now attempting to return Jim Crow, voter suppression, election subversion. Is he laying the groundwork for questioning the 2022 midterms?
It's interesting. He's actually been saying this for a year. He says that if you require voters to have ID to vote, that you support Jim Crow laws. That's an issue that I think 80% of the country supports if the ballot you receive comes from a real voter. And he used that rhetoric to organize a boycott of the state of Georgia. He asked corporations to boycott one of the states of the union, and many of them did. You know, you might remember the Major League Baseball pulled their All-Star game from Georgia to move to Denver in response to Georgia doing pretty little to improve its election laws. It needs to do much, much more than what it did. So I think what they're trying to do is scare people away from improving their election integrity and election security, and that this outlandish rhetoric has always been with that goal in mind. But it's very, you know, you shouldn't call people racist when they're not racist. And it worked really well at the beginning of his presidency, and it's working less well now.
Who was the audience of President Biden's speech in Georgia? Who was he talking to?
I think President Biden has been served by a media that is fairly left-wing and that has been pushing him to do things like push to remove the filibuster and to push radical voting legislation. And so that echo chamber that he's in can provide a disservice when he doesn't realize that much of the country is not as far left, nowhere near as far left as much of the media and other Democrats are. So I don't know how much thinking went into who his speech was for, but he clearly needs to meet some people who aren't in the very tiny echo chamber that is advising him right now.
Lay out your case when you say that the 2020 elections were rigged. What were the three factors that went into these being less than ideal election procedures?
Yeah, the first thing that you kind of already hit on, the pandemic was used as an excuse to change hundreds of voting laws and processes. I mean, literally hundreds of laws and processes were in many cases weakened, and that COVID was the excuse given for why we had to move away from more secure voting processes into less secure voting processes. And sometimes this was done legally. Frequently, it was not done legally. The Constitution requires state legislatures to handle this part of election processes. And in many cases, Democrats used a strategy called sue and settle, where they would sue a friendly state official to get them to change election laws and processes. And it worked in many cases. Then secondly, the other really big part of this was that Mark Zuckerberg, who is one of the world's wealthiest and most powerful men, spent $419 million to finance the private takeover of government election offices. So government election offices are supposed to be neutral, and they're supposed to administer our elections. And they used this money to bring into the process an army of left-wing activists to do everything associated with election administration in a manner that mimics Democrat get-out-the-vote efforts. So they were registering Democratic voters. They were sending messages to Democratic voters to get them to vote. They were translating ballots. They were designing ballots. They were harvesting ballots. They were curing ballots. Curing is where you see that a ballot is about to be rejected for failing to follow the law, and you either take it back to the voter, you know, the Democratic voter, or you fix it yourself. In some states, you're allowed to. They were counting ballots. I mean, every part of the process was being done through this left-wing financing, and they focused those funds on Democratic areas of swing states. So Philadelphia for Pennsylvania, Atlanta for Georgia, all the big cities of Wisconsin for Wisconsin. And it really was a smart strategy. It's totally wrong to do. Obviously, you can't have billionaires controlling your elections. But it was enough to affect the margin of vote in key states. Independent analysts just showed that this Zuckerberg funding was more than enough to change the vote in Wisconsin from a Trump win to a Biden win, meaning without the funding, they wouldn't have been able to run this get out the vote operation in the blue cities that made the difference for that. And then there's just a tangled mess of all sorts of other things, whether it's media bias, media censorship, big tech censorship, where they controlled algorithms, where they deplatformed effective conservative voices, where they worked very hard and even openly to affect the outcome of the election. And it was not good. We can't do elections this way. You need to have elections where winners and losers can trust the results. And that requires work from different political groups to make sure that no matter who the winner or the loser is, that they can have confidence.
So let's go back through those, Molly. And if you would, what's the solution to beginning with sue and settle, these kind of coercive tactics to get local election procedures and laws changed?
Well, it's not a very exciting solution, but I think Democrats spent decades and a lot of money on their plan. They have really put the work in on their strategy of decreasing election security and kind of expanding opportunities for litigation. They're really good at litigating, you know, one side of an issue when they're on the losing side and the exact opposite side of the issue when they're on the winning side. For instance, Mark Elias, the guy who ran the operation to change the laws, he was arguing that Dominion voting systems were corrupt when he was on the losing side of a congressional race in New York. But then, of course, he argued the other side, that such a thought was insane to think when he was advocating for Biden's victory in various states. So he just picks whatever he needs for a given situation. But Republicans need to spend the money and the effort to counter this approach. They need to be aware of what's going on. I write in the book about how for a long time, they actually were legally prohibited from being involved in Election Day litigation. It's kind of a crazy story. They got embroiled in a consent decree out of New Jersey in the early 1980s, and they ended up being kept under that consent decree for nearly 40 years. And it limited what they could do on Election Day oversight and litigation and doing this kind of lawsuit that would change voting laws. And they finally got out from under it, I think, in 2018. So 2020 was the first election where they could really play a role. It's amazing, actually, that Republicans have won anything at the presidential level since then, given how constrained they were. So high-level donors and strategists need to be on top of things, but so do grassroots workers. I hear grassroots people, you know, getting very despairing about how much Democrats have been able to rig the system, and it's understandable, but they need to get out and actually be observing themselves if they want to be confident in the integrity of the vote, that they, in the risk-prone areas of their own states, are overseeing the election, the ballot counting and processing process.
How do you solve a problem like Mark Zuckerberg and his money?
That's really tricky. I mean, one of the states that I looked into for rigged was Wisconsin, because historically they have really good voting laws. They have it in their constitution, you know, that you have a right to vote, that absentee voting is a privilege. They protect people who don't want to vote. You know, sometimes there's too much pressure for people to vote, and they actually, you know, put it in there that you can't be compelled to vote, which is a lot of what we've been seeing recently. If any state was going to make sure that a billionaire couldn't take over their election system, you would think it was Wisconsin. And I asked the people there, like, how did you let this happen? And they said they just had no idea. So the localization of our election system has been a strength. It can be a weakness too. Obviously, a corrupt local area can be known for corruption. You see that in Chicago and Detroit and Philadelphia. But it lessens the probability of widespread corruption or coordinated widespread corruption. But with Zuckerberg's wealth, he was able to figure out a way to make the corruption happen in a coordinated and widespread fashion. Many states have moved to make this private takeover of government election offices illegal. It's obviously not something that you want to have happen. But even in Wisconsin, when the legislature did that, the governor vetoed it, the Democratic governor, knowing how important it was to his party's prospects. And so you just have to keep advocating. And they I think they worked something out to limit it, but much more needs to be done. And, you know, there are certain states that are really bad when it comes to election security, like New York State. And it's one of those states that is so controlled by one party that it looks like it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Finally, on the third prong, the conglomerate of kind of old style media, social media, and all of the incredible, let's just use the word collusion between the two to thwart the message of people who are with an R behind their name. Where do you even begin on that, Molly?
It's a really big problem. The media they've been known to be extremely biased for decades, but in the last 5 years, they just moved into overt propaganda. They're not even ashamed about it. They view themselves as political actors. And I think, you know, that they have a lot of power. And one of the things that has to be done is that people just have to treat them like what they are. They have chosen to behave as propagandists, so they should be treated as propagandists. They do not get the right to moderate, you know, debates. Actually, I just saw this week that the RNC said that they are going to be much stronger on moving out of the Presidential Debate Commission, which is where they would have these left-wing broadcasters ask the questions at presidential debates, as if they have any right to present themselves as moderators when they are usually much fiercer activists than the actual Democratic candidates that are running in a given contest. And so I think for a long time they held a privilege and stature based on this idea that they were neutral arbiters. And now that they have chosen to move so dramatically away from that, they cannot, you know, it's just insane to treat them as something that they frankly never were, but they openly admit they're not now.
You say that the GOP old timers really don't get their voters on election integrity. What do you mean by that, Molly?
Oh my goodness. It's like the number one issue for most Republican voters is concern about the integrity of our elections. They understand many of the ways that the 2020 election was compromised. And right now, this week, Democrats are pushing to federalize control of our elections And this week, a lot of senators would be asked by corrupt media types, like, can you deny that there were any problems with the 2020 election? And they would answer in this mealy-mouthed way. They should know the facts well enough to respond that we cannot have elections where Republicans get treated like second-class citizens by the media and big tech, where the processes are changed in the middle of the game by a, you know, coordinated campaign that's unconstitutional in many cases, that you have billionaires taking over these government election offices. And instead, they would say, well, of course, yeah, no big problems, no major problems that we could see. And it's just, it's an issue that nearly every Republican voter is very concerned about, and they're looking for leadership and not people who kowtow to media narratives that bear no resemblance to reality. But this is true. When I wrote that piece, I heard back from so many people. I thought I should just turn over my email to Mitch McConnell so he can read what everybody's saying. And many of the responses were that it wasn't just voting issues. It's like every issue out there. They feel that the establishment is out of touch with what they are concerned about. And I think you see that on both left and right. And it explains a lot about the political disruption of recent years, that both left and right are increasingly frustrated with how the establishment has made a regime that works well for them, but not for a lot of the American people.
We're discussing election integrity with Molly Hemingway of The Federalist and Fox News. This is Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Faith Lutheran School in Plano, Texas is a classical Lutheran school serving students in preschool through 12th grade. Faith Lutheran will host a high school-specific open house on Thursday evening, February the 10th, and a school-wide open house on Wednesday night, February the 16th. Learn more at flsplano.org, Faith Lutheran School, Plano, Texas, flsplano.org. Do the two so-called voting rights bills have a chance to make it through? We'll answer that question with Molly Hemingway next.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
If you appreciate Issues Etc., our 24/7 music and talk stations, and our daily verse-by-verse Bible study, The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Not everyone is comfortable with new technology. Dial A Podcast gives all generations of your congregation an easy way to hear your sermons, or even devotionals and Bible studies. Once you've completed a simple one-time setup, we take care of the rest. All your congregants have to do is dial the number from any phone to listen to your latest podcast, all at no additional cost to them. Dial A Podcast. Extend the reach of your sermons. Get started at dialapodcast.com now.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
So what they did was they moved the goalpost because they had to keep fighting, right? But there was no one on the other side. And so now that there was a consensus about what counts as racism and how evil racism is, they changed the definition of what counts as racism.
I don't know how much more wrong you could get, but when the justices, especially the liberal ones, were focused on the policy arguments. If they're going to start with policy first, you better get the facts right, and they completely dropped the ball on that.
It's a serious thing to misuse God's name, and God threatens with eternal punishment those who do such things. These are people who need to repent, and those who are listening to them need to stop.
The Lord speaks to us in His Word, the preaching of His Word, the study of His Word, the conversation about His Word, the blessings that come from reflecting on His Word. That's how the Lord speaks to us. And then we respond and speak back to Him in our prayers.
In about 10 minutes, your votes for Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. You can vote by giving us a call, 1-877-623-MYIE. In the meantime, Molly Hemingway is our guest. We're talking about election integrity. Molly, do the two so-called voting rights bills that the president has been talking about so much, do they have a chance of making it through?
I don't think that they will pass right now, but I don't think that's entirely the goal, too. I think one thing that Democrats have been wise about is how to move discussions over time. So they might propose something really extreme, say restricting gun rights or something like that, and it has no chance of working, and it might even cause some electoral problems for them in the short term. But over time, it works to their benefit, and it changes the way people think about, you know, what was formerly understood to be foundational or constitutional. And so I'll just be honest, I really don't understand totally what they're doing or why they're calling everybody racist or why they continue to move in a direction that has yielded what was like the most recent poll showed 33% approval for Joe Biden. And that was from a left-wing pollster that always gilds the lily for Democrats. So I don't think they understand what they're doing either entirely. But I do think the people who care about election integrity or care about some of these other constitutional issues can't just relax because it doesn't have a great chance of passing right now. They need to make the principled case against what's going on and educate the people about why some of these things are important, including local control of elections.
Is there a chance, a realistic chance, that the filibuster is either modified in its rules or eliminated altogether?
Well, I think with Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin being quite clear and consistent that they are not interested in doing that, again, not right now, but they certainly have wildly changed some of their previous views on the Democrats in general have changed. And there is truth to the problem that we're seeing in the Senate and in Congress. These two entities turned over a lot of their power to the executive branch, and they are reaping the consequences of that. And now they're trying to figure out how to be effective or how to continue to play a role in the country's laws and policies. And so it's okay to have some discussions about how to do that, but doesn't seem like it's going to happen right now that we destroy minority rights in the Senate. I think it's also interesting, the House has never been an institution that had like particular minority rights, but Nancy Pelosi has also changed she's arguably destroyed the House of Representatives as well. She's moved it into a nothing but majoritarian institution, violating her own rules. And I do worry about, you know, you can't go back from that. And I don't think we will go back from that. And a lot of the norms that were associated, even with the lower chamber, have just gone away. And it's entirely likely that Republicans will take control in November. And they're not going to go back to like giving Democrats a lot of leeway in how to set committees now that Nancy Pelosi has moved away from that during her last tenure.
With respect to the recent actions, I was listening to National Public Radio this morning, and one of the commentators on a domestic roundup said, you know, it's hard to not come to the conclusion at this point that the Biden administration is not good at politics. He made a trip to meet with the senators yesterday, immediately after Senator Sinema's speech. He came out of that yelling so much in that particular chamber that everyone in the room kind of stopped and stared at him talking to the reporters. This is from perhaps the most seasoned politician of our generation who's still alive. What are your thoughts?
I noticed that this week, a lot of people who worked very hard to ensure that Joe Biden was elected president have had a change of heart, or they're expressing surprise at the way he's acting. I heard even the Republicans who are kind of known for not liking the previous president expressing surprise that Joe Biden would give a speech where he called, for instance, Mitch McConnell racist. Well, Joe Biden's been calling people racist for a very long time. I remember when Mitt Romney was running for president, he said that Republicans wanted to put black people in chains. And when he began his 2020 campaign, he began with lies about what President Trump had said regarding the Charlottesville disaster that involved removing a Robert E. Lee statue. And that's just kind of how he's been. And so I think it's a little frustrating for a lot of people to see people who say, oh, you know, I thought he was going to be moderate, or I was okay with him becoming president because he was going to be a unifier and moderate. I think people who say that should not be listened to in the future. They're not good at analyzing what Joe Biden always was. Anybody who sat through his control of the Judiciary Committee when Clarence Thomas was, when he was nominated, knows that Joe Biden can be very vicious and that he has a track record going back decades of kind of being who he is. And just because people were so desperate to get rid of President Trump that they created this other narrative that he was a nice, genuine, lovely, moderate guy. People who said things like that should, like I said, not be listened to in the future.
Republicans control 30 state legislatures, Molly. Are there any good examples of state legislatures making progress on election integrity?
Actually, I think quite a few of them are. It's one of the good things out of a really bad post-2020 election season where, you know, you had the riot and other bad things like that. But like I mentioned, Democrats have cared deeply about this issue and invested deeply in the issue of how they want elections run for a very long time. And Republicans just kind of weren't there. And now it's an issue that they care about at a very deep and visceral level, and they're putting the work into it. And so, you know, I already mentioned Wisconsin, which I think is a good example of a state that is thinking through how it wants its elections run, how they can be secure, and how it balances their state interests. And everybody's kind of making, I mean, all the Republican-led states are making meager efforts. I mentioned Georgia needs to do much more. That's what was so shocking about the huge pushback that they got. They didn't really do that much. And just in general, I think flooding the system with tens of millions of mail-in ballots without appropriate levels of voter ID is just a disaster. And it's going to continue to be a disaster whether Republicans win or whether they lose, whether Democrats win or whether they lose. You just want systems where people can truly be confident in the outcome. And so I would also just say we have been fighting about election laws for the entirety of our history. So people shouldn't act like it's a big deal that we have to do this. I mean, a couple decades ago, the Democratic Party in the South kind of prohibited all black people from voting, or nearly all black people. And we didn't give up on the country. We just worked to make sure that they could vote and that the party could not keep them from voting. And so you just, everybody has to deal with this in their own time. And this is an issue that we have to care about. But now it seems like finally everybody realizes that work is there to be done.
So if both sides, both the Democratic, who've been in, had the ground game going much longer, as you say, and now the Republican side, given our two-party system, getting in that game finally, does that mean that the net result is better, more trustworthy elections?
I hope so. It's, I mean, it completely depends on how everybody does it, but they need to understand the issues in play. I have been covering a little bit about how people got involved, like in Virginia, which is my state, which was not even a state that had a likelihood of electing a Republican, and they ended up electing Republicans at all state level offices in this last election. But you had a lot of people become informed about what the laws were. Democrats had changed and loosened up the rules quite a bit, but they weren't even following those rules. Like, some election observers noticed that ballots were being accepted without any ID. You know, you're supposed to put your last four digits of your social security number or something like that. They were accepting them even though they didn't have that. And they became aware. They attempted to fight it. They actually lost that battle. So those ballots were accepted. But this is very important. Our entire republic rests on this, our elections being free and fair. And it's just the work that we have to do. And if we do it well, and if we're smart about it, then hopefully the republic can thrive.
You mentioned the Virginia elections, and I think that will serve as, in many ways, perhaps a template for 2022. What did we learn from, it almost sounds like a replay of yesterday, someone who was an incumbent governor playing every card he could possibly play from the Everybody's a Racist playbook, contrasted with Youngkin.
It's so interesting to me because the Democratic candidate was not a bad candidate per se. He was a previous governor. He had a lot of money. He wasn't as left-wing as some of the other Democratic nominees that you see being put forth. But he ran a really horrible campaign. I wonder, though, if just the biggest lesson is that normal people were getting really fed up with authoritarian regimes. So it's not a particularly conservative state. I mean, it is in most of it, except that the place where the people live in Northern Virginia, where most people live, it's not conservative at all. But people really got sick and tired of some of the restrictions and lockdowns on schools. Children had been banned from schools or really had their school lives disrupted for years, and nobody was responding to them. They were pushing this racist critical race theory curriculum in the schools, and nobody was listening to them. And so I'm not sure how much of the larger meaningful lesson is there, except that as the Democratic Party seems to be getting taken over by its more like far left, crazy progressive wing, the more it alienates itself from just that vast majority of Americans who might not be that conservative, but are just seeking normalcy.
What's at stake here, Molly? What's the danger of the American electorate not trusting the integrity of their own elections?
It's very sad to see that we have had, you know, we've gone through periods of this throughout our history of political violence, but you've seen this uptick in political violence being used as a way to affect change, whether it was the summer of violence in 2020, where left-wing groups just attacked everything from the White House to a federal courthouse for months to police precincts. And then because I think of our failure to respond to that and because of our failure to be responsive to so many issues, you're starting to see an openness to this on the right as well. And I worry that if you take away free and fair elections and you already have had kind of a history of political violence on the left and you're seeing an openness to it on the right, that we are really risking a greater level of political violence in this country, which is not a good thing.
Molly Hemingway is a Fox News contributor. She's senior editor at The Federalist, author of the new book, Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections, and a recent column for The Federalist titled GOP's Old Guard Out of Touch with Their Voters on Election Integrity. You can read it and purchase Rigged at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Molly, thanks.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week.
Modern children's animations often seem to have it out for fathers. They portray them in the worst way. Fathers are the bumbling idiots. They're morons. They don't know what's going on. Is this a godly way to portray those who are responsible for raising us in the fear and instruction of the Lord? Well, if you have that question and you'd like to learn more about this, you need to pick up a January issue of The Lutheran Witness. We talk about fathers, mothers, and so much more. Visit witness.lcms.org to learn more or order your copy at cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Does this sound like your church budget process at the end of the year? You get last year's budget and go through with a committee line by line, maybe what we should spend next year. Maybe you have a prayer. But where's the Word of God in this process? When do the people hear what the small catechism says about giving and why we do it? Contact us at LCMS Stewardship so that we can help you fix this process, put the Word of God first, and put your congregation on a good footing. lcms.org/stewardship.
Memoria Press's award-winning Latin programs are designed to teach your student to master Latin grammar through an easy-to-use step-by-step process. By studying Latin, your student will gain an academic vocabulary, a mastery of English grammar, and develop sound critical thinking skills. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next purchase by using the coupon code LPR22. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. MemoriaPress.com.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Is James' teaching on faith, works, and justification reconcilable with the rest of Scripture?
The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for January is the new Concordia Commentary on James. It's written by Issues Etc. guest Dr. Curtis Giese. The Concordia Commentary on James is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. The Concordia Commentary on James, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month.
This is Deaconess Betsy Dodgers at Concordia University Chicago, inviting all high school students to attend the annual Careers for Christ weekend in person on our beautiful campus in River Forest. Careers for Christ is February 4th through 6th. You'll have the opportunity to learn about professional church vocations while having fun with CUC staff, faculty, and students. For more information, visit cuchicago.edu/C4C.
Do you long for a church where the gospel of the sinner's free justification is front and center, and yet where a robust sacramental life is confessed and lived? Do you long for a church that rejoices in the sacred scriptures as the sole basis for the church's teaching and proclamation, yet values and listens to the witness of the ancient fathers and councils? Welcome to the Lutheran Church. We're what you've been looking for. Find a Christ-centered, cross-focused church near you on the Find the Church page at issuesetc.org.